This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. Our main story this week is the electromotive diesel lockout in London, Ontario. We'll also be interviewing Marianne Larico, President of Public Service Alliance of Canada Local 901. PSAC 901 represents graduate student teaching assistants and teaching fellows at Queen's University in Kingston.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
Negotiations between Queen's University and the United Steelworkers continued throughout December. The USW represents over 1,200 academic support staff at the university. Bargaining dates are scheduled to proceed until the end of February. Queen's University staff voted in favor of union representation in March of 2010. The USW membership includes almost 7,000 members working as university staff across Canada.
On November 29th, student academic workers represented by QP 3902 at the University of Toronto voted 91% in favor of a strike in the event that negotiations with the employer break down. After 5 months, negotiations are ongoing. The union has been without a contract for over 200 days. QP 3902 officials point out that real wages have flattened as the cost of living increases. Workloads have also risen since members of 3902 signed their previous contract in 2008. The university negotiators refused to negotiate tutorial sizes. Enrollment in some tutorials has exceeded 500 students. James Nugent, the QP 3902 Bargaining Committee's chief spokesperson, stated in a press release that, quote, "The university administration still refuses to address the core problems facing graduate student teachers and undergraduate students." After a two-hour caucus between the two parties on December 5th, the U of T informed QP negotiators that they would not discuss a handful of proposals forwarded by the union. Following the university's refusal to negotiate key issues, the administration applied for conciliation with the Ministry of Labor without union support. According to Wayne Dealey, chair of QP 3902, quote, "The call for a conciliation officer was premature, and that the union is willing to sit down at the table at any time with the administration, with or without the Ministry of Labor officer. No confirmed dates have been set."
The Canadian Association of University Teachers has condemned the government of Manitoba's decision to order members of the Brandon University Faculty Association to vote on the Brandon University's final offer. As a November 23rd letter written by CAUT President Wayne Peters and Executive Director James Turk states, "The effect of the government's intervention is to undermine the collective bargaining process by taking away the employer's incentive to negotiate, and thereby likely prolonging the strike. Under threat in the Manitoba case is the right to free and fair collective bargaining." The CAUT represents more than 66,000 teachers, librarians, researchers, and other academic professionals and general staff from universities across Canada.
Workers at Zellers in Burnaby, BC are challenging the efforts of American retail giant Target to break their union. Of the 135 Zellers stores being bought by Target, 15 are unionized. The United Food and Commercial Workers, representing the Burnaby Zellers employees, has filed a challenge under the province's Labor Relations Board. Well-established labor laws across Canada require that new owners of a firm inherit any existing unions. Like retail giant Walmart, Target has a confirmed anti-union record. The retail sector remains one of the least unionized in Canada.
On December 9th, the Nova Scotia Legislature passed Bill 102, which amends the province's Trade Union Act. This amendment allows an arbitrator or government-appointed board the ability to impose a one-year contract on a workplace if a first collective agreement cannot be reached after 120 days of bargaining and conciliation. The provincial NDP government advanced the bill on the grounds that it will boost productivity and avoid labor disruptions. Businesses, including Sobeys and Michelin, have publicly denounced the bill as damaging to the province's economic competitiveness. The opposition Liberal and Tories also denounced the bill as unfair to employers and, quote, "a job killer." While Bill 102 amends the province's Trade Union Act, Premier Daryl Dexter has categorically rejected a repeal of the so-called Michelin Bill passed in 1979. This bill has been instrumental in helping Michelin defeat numerous unionization drives.
On December 30th, Acadian Coach Lines took its buses off the road to head off a strike. The company operates bus routes in New Brunswick and Prince Edward Island. Drivers at Acadian are represented by the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1229. Reports indicate that there is no end in sight for the dispute, which has entered its second month. The company's decision to lock out employees has disrupted regularly scheduled intercity bus service that connects to routes in PEI, Nova Scotia, and Quebec. The union offered to submit to binding arbitration, but the employer refused. Since the labor dispute began, employees have had their drug coverage discontinued, and the company is withholding banked vacation funds. The union expects Acadian Coach Lines to cut medical benefits and RSP contributions as well. Negotiations are not expected to resume until mid-January.
800 workers at Rio Tinto Alcan's Alma Quebec plant were locked out January 1st after last-minute negotiations failed. On Friday, December 30th, the workers from three negotiating units within the company voted down the proposed deal. Rio Tinto Alma has pushed to increase its use of subcontract labor, a position the Syndicat des Métallos, which represents workers at the plant, oppose. Union leaders are accusing managers of hiring scabs to operate the facility after locking out hundreds of unionized employees. The Alma facility hosts one of Rio Tinto Alcan's most important North American aluminum smelters.
The over 200 transit workers of York Region Transit have been on strike for 11 weeks. Nearly all members of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 113 met in December to consider the company's latest proposal. The proposal was met with shouts of "no deal" from the floor and a motion to, quote, "not even vote on this piece of crap" received a unanimous show of hands. Members of ATU 1587 in York Region are also on strike against Miller Transit and First Canada. The major grievance by York Region transit workers is the wage gap between themselves and their counterparts in Greater Toronto.
The Greater Toronto Workers' Assembly, a coalition of labor activists, is calling upon QP National to organize a movement of opposition to Mayor Ford's war on Toronto workers. The contracts for 28,000 City of Toronto workers, represented by QP Locals 79 and 416, expired on December 31st. Attempts at conciliation have so far failed. With a lockout or strike looming for early February, the City of Toronto's Labor Relations Committee has been issued a new mandate to its bargaining team. City Councilor Janet Davis doesn't believe the new mandate will lead to a settlement, describing the mandate as, quote, "extreme." Another city councilor, Shelley Carroll, commented, "What we are dealing with here is an extremist, radical conservative agenda. Mayor Ford has openly stated his desire to repeal job security for city workers in a bid to accelerate the privatization of public services."
As the clock struck midnight on New Year's Eve, 700 workers at Electromotive Diesel in London, Ontario, found themselves locked out. Negotiations between the union and the employer, Progress Rail, a subsidiary of Caterpillar, had fallen apart earlier in 2011. Caterpillar is demanding the elimination of pensions, reductions in benefits, and a massive wage cut from $35 an hour to $16.50 an hour. Union members voted 97% in favor of a strike mandate.
Reports are already coming in that the company is removing machinery from the plant to move the assembly of locomotives to a facility in Muncie, Indiana, where workers are paid as little as $12 an hour. Meanwhile, sales of machinery to the mining sector has set Caterpillar on course for record levels of profit and revenue. CAW leaders, including Union President Ken Luenza, have denounced the company's demands and are preparing for a long, difficult battle against an employer well known in the United States for union busting. In an interview with Rank and File Radio, Rick Laporte of CAW Local 444 in Windsor described the unfolding labor dispute as critical to all workers and the company's actions as part of the race to the bottom. He is concerned about the effect the strike will have on upcoming negotiations with Chrysler.
Trade unionists are also directing their fire at the federal government for its subsidies to EMD. It was 3 years ago, in 2008, that Prime Minister Harper stood on the shop floor of Electromotive to announce a billion-dollar tax break for industry. The plant itself garnered $5 million in tax breaks. On June 1, 2010, Caterpillar purchased the Electromotive plant in London, Ontario.
At least 1,000 other tertiary jobs are at stake in the London area with the lockout. The city of 350,000 has one of the highest unemployment rates in Canada, at 9.8%. The region in general has been hit hard since the economic crisis began in 2008. Chatham's Navistar truck assembly plant closed in August, with 1,200 union jobs being lost. Another 1,200 jobs were lost in September, with the end of the last shift at the Ford assembly plant between London and St. Thomas.
Across Canada, public and private sector unions are experiencing a wave of anti-union and anti-worker opposition from companies and governments. Even though companies like Caterpillar continue to be profitable, largely due to their connection with the resource sector, they are demanding massive concessions from workers. The pressure on organized labor to mount a response to employers is not lost on Rick Laporte, who is already organizing a busload of Windsor workers to visit the picket lines in London. He emphasizes that unions between Windsor and Toronto should be doing the same. The CAW, supported by the Ontario Federation of Labour, is organizing a mass demonstration in London in support of the workers on Saturday, January 21st. Solidarity actions are expected to be organized across the province and beyond. Stay tuned to Rank and File Radio as we cover developments from Electromotive as they happen.
I mean, if there's a listener-supported radio station, it means that people can get
daily, every day, a different way of looking at the world, not just what the corporate media want you to see, but a different picture, different understanding, but a different picture, a different understanding. Not only can you hear it, but you can participate in it. You can add your own thoughts, you know, and you can learn something and so on. Well, that's the way, people become human, you know. That's the way you become human participants in a social and political system.
Keep your thumb on the pulse of global issues. Tune into Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, heard right here on CFRC 101.9 FM on weekdays from noon to 1 p.m. and rebroadcast again weekdays at 7 a.m. Democracy Now! Provides their audience with access to people and perspectives rarely heard in the U.S. corporate-sponsored media. Tune in or check them out online at democracynow.org.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/CFRC.
All right, welcome back. Graduate teaching assistants and teaching fellows at Queen's University voted in favor of certification with the Public Service Alliance of Canada on March 23, 2010. Over a year later, in May of 2011, TAs and TFs finally ratified their first collective agreement. Our first guest today is Marianne Larico. In addition to being president of PSAC 901, the very first president of the local, in fact, Marianne is also a PhD candidate in the Department of English. Marianne, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So for starters, Marianne, tell us about your experience with trade unionism. How did it begin?
So in 2008, I volunteered with TAFA, that's the Teaching Assistant and Teaching Fellows Association, working towards unionizing graduate student teaching assistants and fellows on campus with the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Andrew, you yourself were one of the steering committee organizers. So props to your team for, you know, inspiring another round of activists. So I started and volunteered with that. There was, in 2008, there was a vote to unionize. It was a temporary setback. I think there were 39, certification was short, 39 votes. So the Public Service Alliance of Canada saw that as a temporary setback and said, no, you know, we're going to try again. It's too close of a margin. And of course, activists put their, you know, heart and soul into these things. So it's hard for people to stay on for a second drive and continue. So I worked with a smaller group of activists to aim for union certification a second time. So we started an organizing drive. It started very low-key with one-on-one meetings to get actual feedback from potential members about their working conditions. And by doing that, we built a base of people who understood that we had personal accountability with them. That meant that we were actually compiling real issues, and the drive became an issue-driven drive. After that successful union vote in March 2010, we began the tedious process of bargaining. That was a huge learning curve for me, and I'm so grateful to have experienced bargaining for our first collective agreement here. So we bargained with Kim Beamer. She's the regional negotiator who's leaving PSAC now to work with the government. But she was phenomenal. So we have a really solid first collective agreement. We worked hours and hours with a team of about 15 on the bargaining committee and 8 people on the core committee. That collective agreement was ratified in May 2011. So it's just being implemented right now as we speak, the terms and conditions, September 2011. And if I can say anything, it's been a bumpy ride for everyone, the university for us. Implementing new sort of rules that everyone has to follow is really difficult to get people in compliance.
What was your first impression of academic work? Did it seem like something that needed to be represented in any way?
My first impression of academic work, well, I guess it's tainted by what I see it as now. So, you know, retrospectively looking at things too, is the academe sort of conditions or can condition us to develop these really sadomasochist relationships with the institution, sadomasochist relationships in terms of exploitation. And, you know, professors go through these sorts of ritualized rites of passage. And then, you know, with the sentiment of, I went through it, you know you're going to go through it, and you better believe you're going to make someone else go through it. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're so vulnerable to exploitation.
How has the unionization of teaching assistants and teaching fellows here at Queen's helped to improve the conditions of work and the quality of academic services being offered by those workers?
Right. So outside of, you know, the sadomasochist relationship, is we're also conditioned to be really respectful of professors. We rely on the universities to give us reference if we need to go on in the academic sector. One of the things that unionization does is it creates a set of conditions and rules for everyone to follow. So there's no sort of falling between the cracks because we didn't know that was going on, or individuals negotiating what's best for them. It creates, you know, a standard way for people to operate. So that includes professors, that includes the university, that includes us as workers, as employees. Because we know what rules to play by, we can sort of develop a sense of what we deserve as employees, because without a set of rules, without a set of, like, knowing what our job descriptions are even, we're sort of stabbing in the dark. And that doesn't create, you know, the most efficient kind of work, the most productive kind of work, or the most efficient services for undergraduate students in the community. So unionizing actually protects the work that we do.
I want you to explain a bit more about how unionization fits into the primary mission, really, of a university, which is providing academic services. Some would say, to be a devil's advocate here, yep, that unions represent workers as employees. What about the role of teaching assistants and teaching fellows as providing academic services as academic workers? How does a union help improve those conditions?
Well, one of the, you know, basic things is by providing benefits, wage increases to sort of reflect the work that's done. And by doing that, by, you know, garnering these protections, wages and benefits, you create a healthier sort of work environment and a safer work environment as well.
Now, you outed me as a previous organizer here at Queen's, starting with TAFA, as you said, in 2008. Now, there was an experience that I saw coming from this, and some people would say, rightly or wrongly, that there might be a divide between the graduate teaching assistants and teaching fellows from the hard sciences, from the social sciences, and between that and the humanities. Tell us a bit about this.
I'd say it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, there seems to be a lot of miscommunication and misrepresentation and just a lot of misunderstandings just about unionism in general, what different disciplines do all the time. I remember during one of the drives, somebody from a science, hard science department was like, but you guys in the humanities and social sciences make less than us. And I had to show that person my pay stub to say we get paid the same rate. That rate is the same across the board. I think there has to be a better communication and understanding of what we do as TAs in different disciplines. I personally, being in English, I don't do labs or work with sensitive chemicals, so I can't really fully appreciate those working conditions. But it doesn't make me value it any less or any more. And I think it's really important that there needs to be an openness between disciplines in an interdisciplinary way to sort of be open to appreciating what everybody does and value it in a way that they would want their own work to be valued.
PSAC 901 is a member of the Kingston District Labor Council. How does PSAC 901 as a local and a member of the Labor Council contribute?
So the Kingston District Labor Council, as labor councils all over the country and or even provincially, are really important sort of hubs for unions in a community. So all the different, you know, national unions are represented there, as well as community voices can come out and talk about workers' issues, and not only worker issues, community issues, but and it's really important to understand that those aren't mutually exclusive. Because the labor movement is at the base a social justice movement as well. So 901 does sit at the Kingston District Labor Council, and we do have voice and vote. I believe we can send about 6 delegates right now. And what we've done is raise awareness about the academic sector and raise awareness about the Public Service Alliance of Canada as well, because I think we're the first PSAC local to sit on PSAC directly chartered local to sit at on KDLC. So it was really important for us to sort of bring that voice. And in addition, a lot of the analysis that's coming from 901 is the unionism is slightly more radical than what they're used to at the Labor Council.
Can you talk a bit more about that? What do you define as a radical union, and a union that's active in what you said to be social justice activism?
Right. So I'm hesitant to use the word radical here to go into some sort of definition. But I mean, there are different kinds of unionism out there. For example, people who believe in the type of unionisms that really value seniority versus, you know, new and emerging types of unionism that really care about championing equity issues, right? And they're usually seen as being in sort of conflict with each other. But like one of the things that 901 has gotten behind has been radical holidays like May Day, for example. In Canada, we don't celebrate May Day, we celebrate Labor Day in September, and that's a co-opted sort of holiday. So we wanted to voice this idea of, you know, we should be having a May Day march and barbecue sort of thing. And that maybe got out of some people's comfort zones, but it was a fantastic event. And I mean, it's not the first of its kind in Kingston. MayWorks definitely came before that, and the Labor Council had supported that initiative before as well. It's this idea of involving the community with labor issues, because if we don't have the general public behind us, you know, what do we have behind us?
Earlier, you were about to elaborate further on collective bargaining and the round of bargaining here that led to a collective agreement. What were some of the central issues that PSAC 901 faced during the recent round of bargaining at Queen's University?
One of the biggest things that we faced, well, things that were really important, were this idea of funding. So at Queen's, our wage rate raises were illusory. So great, on paper we get 36 something an hour, but every time we got a raise, it was just being clawed back off our total funding packages. So how is that actually a raise for the work we do? We're better off not taking work and just taking the funding package for nothing, right? To not do any work. But so we fought to get a memorandum in place that protects people's funding, overall funding packages, to say that it won't be clawed back if there is a raise, and there will be raises because we did negotiate wage raises, but there won't be any clawbacks on your QGAs or other sources of funding. Another thing that we really fought for, and this has been a continued fight, is to get equity statistic reporting. Right now, the Council of Employment Equity and the Equity Office, they report statistics based on, you know, the 4 identified equity groups at Queen's, but they do that for employee groups only, and they don't count students. And the problem is that grad students are students, but they're also TAs, and TAs and TFs are employees, right? That's how we have a bargaining certificate. So one of the biggest things we gained as well on the equity side of things is equity statistic reporting, and I think that's going to set a precedent, you know, with other university campuses actually across Canada. So that was a huge gain for us as well, and we also secured benefits. We thought, but a lot of people said, you know, there's no way you can negotiate benefits in this climate in a first collective agreement, and we did it, right? We gained benefits. Also, my goodness, the grievance procedure. Every collective agreement can't be held up without a grievance procedure. It's so important. So that alone as well, and health and safety language.
If anyone's looked at the collective agreement, you will notice that there is a great deal of information, benefits, and services in it. When you mentioned the local labor council, you used a few words here, directly chartered local.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us why PSAC 901 decided to become a directly chartered local, and how does that compare to the alternative, a chartered local? What is the difference?
Or a component, you mean.
Sorry, a component.
So the Public Service Alliance, the structure of it, it's made up of locals. It's made up of members, of course. Then members make up locals. Locals make up either components or directly chartered locals. And that makes up the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Components really mirror the structure of the government. So they're sort of federally based structures where locals fit in. Okay, so basically locals within components, they report to, or their political structure is on a national level, in the sense that let's take Union of National Defense Employees. There can be locals all over Canada, but they are sort of centrally governed by the component UNDE. On the other side of it is the directly chartered local that doesn't necessarily fit into a federalized sector. So like us, in the academic sector, we don't have a government body to mirror. The political structure that directly chartered locals report to, it's directly tied to the umbrella union, the Public Service Alliance of Canada. So as a local, we have autonomy because we can negotiate the terms and conditions of the way we fit into our union directly with our union, whereas locals within components have the component structure to go through before you can even go and access the Public Service Alliance of Canada.
So you're talking here about the bigger structure and question of union organization, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, and subsequently its constituent elements, which is the locals operating in the workplace. What role do union locals play in making policy within the parent union structure?
Just like other unions, we do have conventions, regional and national conventions. They're triennial, so they're every 3 years, and actually PSAC is having one coming up at the end of April 2012. And so through resolutions, which are submitted in advance of the conventions, rank and file members from directly chartered locals can submit through their executives resolutions to change bylaws or to change dues structures, finance things, or to send off general political resolutions that sort of steer the direction of the union in whole. If you're a local in a component, it would have to get passed at a component convention before it could go to PSAC regional or national conventions. So that's one way that locals can, rank and file members from within locals can sort of engage their larger union. It's through conventions, it's through lobbying, and also through organizing and through collective bargaining. One of the things that's really interesting is that through collective bargaining, you can change things, not only at the union level, but at the level of legislation as well.
Final question. What lies ahead for PSAC 901 here at Queen's?
Oh my gosh, it is just the beginning. We are trying to do a million things at once, and a lot of times we're flying by the seats of our pants, but the local is brand new. We're developing. We have all sorts of different committees. And really, it's about being flexible to what the members want to do. And that's really the most important thing is trying to get, you know, rank and file members engaged in these things. And I think really it lies in the one-on-one structure, sort of making people personally accountable, recognizing that these issues are their issues as well.
That was Marianne Larico, president of PSAC 901. That's all the time we have this week. Join us next Wednesday, 5:30 to 6, for another episode of Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM.